Well, hello, folks, and welcome to this episode of the Texas Titans podcast. I cannot tell you how grateful I am for you being here today. And by the way, I just want to let you know that the last two episodes, the two-part interview with Luke Coffey, blew the numbers out of the water. So thank you so much for all of you who took the time to listen to Luke's story. And also thank you to those of you who gave Luke and I both a lot of cool feedback about how it impacted your life and how inspired you were by Luke's story. So thank you. Today, I've got a great, great show for you. This is my friend, Craig Keelan. I don't just consider Craig a friend, but he's also a mentor, and he's one of the most accomplished individuals I've ever had the opportunity of knowing. And I think you're going to really enjoy just this. Again, I always say this, I don't really do interviews. I think I just have conversations with a recorder going with friends and people that I'm meeting for the first time that have done something that I find remarkable, and I want to share that relationship or that newfound knowledge that I'm receiving from these high-performing leaders with you, my audience. And that is definitely the case with Craig. So let me get into a little bit about who Craig Keelan is. Craig is a fifth-generation Texan that graduated from the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Finance and Southern Methodist University's Cox School of Business. At the time of this recording, my SMU Mustangs football team are still undefeated, so go Ponies. His lifetime passion has been about leading others to better health and commitment to helping others reach their lifetime goals and improve their character. Since 2003, Craig has developed and launched a family of antioxidant-rich whole food puree products manufactured and distributed by his CK family of companies, which includes Doctors Wellness Solutions, Trinity Nutraceuticals, and Liberty Franklin Pharmaceuticals. Craig's CK Management Organization manages the business of the CK family of companies and their antioxidant-rich whole food puree products. That is just a tip of the iceberg of what Craig Keelan has done. Craig has been in banking. As a matter of fact, he began his professional career in the banking and finance industry, achieving great respect from his professional peers as the founder and CEO of the Heritage Corporation of America and chairman and CEO of Guaranty Bank Dallas. As a financial consultant, Craig worked with several billionaires and was valued for his financial expertise and guidance. Folks, this is one of the most accomplished people that I've ever had the pleasure of knowing, and I'm so glad to bring my conversation with my friend, my mentor, and one unbelievable Texas Titan, Craig Keelan, to you today. Thank you so much for listening. I'm truly grateful. Enjoy the show. Hey, folks, I just wanted to remind you that my new book, Push Play, Taking Your Life Off Pause, the revised and updated edition that includes almost a decade more of wisdom, humility, and stories is now available at Amazon.com. And I would be grateful if you'd pick up a copy. It documents my escape from corporate America at the age of 28 to where I acquired my first company, and then also explains to you how I and encourages others to focus on the life you want to live first. It's not about a job. It's not about trying to grab money. It's not about material things. It's about a life. And, you know, the book was inspired by something that a very dear friend of mine once said, that as he watched his father withering away with cancer, he came to my office and he said, you know, my dad is alive, but he is no longer living. That one phrase really had a profound impact on me, and Push Play, Taking Your Life Off Pause is all about that. It's about living. It's about curating a life of living, not just being alive. It's about soaking every single drop that there is to offer out of this life. I think you'll enjoy it. It's an easy read because, after all, I wrote it, and I do not use big words. So pick up a copy of Push Play, Taking Your Life Off Pause. If you do go buy it, please do me a favor. Go to Amazon and leave a review. I would sure be grateful. Thanks so much. Craig Keelan, how are you, sir?
Awesome.
Man, I tell you what. First of all, thank you so much for making the trip to Tyler. You're in God's country today, and we're so glad to have you. And I appreciate it. You know, I've told you, and I know I sound like a broken record, and I don't want it to come across as false flattery. I have wanted to do this interview for some time now because, you know, your bio kind of reads like this. This is top line. Philanthropist, entrepreneur, just you've done so many cool things. Author, you know, that I have wanted to learn more. And we have mutual friends, and everyone that speaks of you speaks very highly. And so I wanted to kind of peel back the onion and figure out more about who Craig Keeland is, and also and share with my audience who you are. And because I think if there's anyone that deserves the title of Texas Titan, it's Craig Keeland. So first of all, let's get started. Where did it all start? Where are you from? And let's just go from there.
Well, I was born in Dallas, Texas. My grandparents were there. They were in the dry cleaning business. They'd come to Dallas in 1921. At 15 and 17, didn't have two nickels to put together to get a dime. And they were great people. My mother was got married, and I came along. Back in the day, you had to put up money to go to a hospital in advance for the baby, for the mother to go through the childbirth.
Really?
So it's a lot different deal. And so my dad had just gotten out of the Air Force. So they didn't have two nickels to rub together, but they were working in a small town south of Dallas, a good piece way down the road. So my grandparents put some money up so that I could be born in a hospital. And just as they were coming up, they had one car, but my dad needed it for his job. So my mother was on a bus coming back to Dallas. It's about a 6-hour ride. So anyway, during that ride, right before they got to Dallas, her water broke, and then the driver was going to go downtown Dallas at the Greyhound bus station, but he went over to Baylor, which was at that time a small hospital, but an even smaller one across the street where the money was put up for me to be there. And I came out early, and so then I think she got to stay one night at that room that was paid for my grandparents. Wow. So that was in the beginning, which I didn't know about till I was 15, and my grandmother told me that story in front of my mom.
Wow.
So that was it. I loved my grandparents. I was with them a lot, and they were telling me, you've got to save money for college. So at 6 years old, they showed me how to mow this yard. It's a push mower. Mm-hmm. And I pushed it, and I kind of liked that. Yeah. And you know, I picked up $3 every time I'd mow that yard. And then after a month, after I started accumulating this money, I then saw the neighbor next door, and I said, can I do your yard? And he said, yeah. And he says, how much you want to charge me? And I said, $4 a week. He said, okay. So that's how I got started.
6 years old, for already an entrepreneur, cutting grass. My first real job, if you will, my first entrepreneurial venture was cutting grass also, but I waited until I was 13. So I was half your age. Okay, so then what?
Well, I went into first grade, and I failed the first grade.
Really?
Then I went to another school and almost failed it that time as well. So I was always struggling in school. By the time I got to the fourth grade, and one of the teachers said, you know, there's a real issue here. And this is before the word dyslexia had been invented. Mm-hmm. And so I was always struggling and almost didn't even make it through the fourth grade. Mm-hmm. But that was, you know, how I started off in school. So at the end of the day, in high school, when I graduated, out of 361 people, I graduated 356.
Wow.
The only A I ever made was in typing, which I loved, golf, which I loved, business law and business arithmetic. Everything else was right on the border of failing at all times.
Well, now, looking back on that, and I'm asking this because there's a common thread for people with dyslexia. A lot of CEOs, if you look at the numbers on a percentage basis, it's not unusual to find a high percentage of very high achievers with dyslexia because you're forced to work harder just to read. So therefore, that kind of spills over into everything else you have to do. It's just hard work kind of is innate. Did you find that with your deal?
That's all you can do.
Yeah.
You just got to work harder and longer to stay in the game.
Right. So you finish high school, mm-hmm. and then was college something that was just expected? You were going to do it. You said you're saving money. So what happens after school?
Well, I went to school, and I thought I could get in at college, and they didn't take me. So then I went to a junior college. They just opened up around Dallas, four of them.
Okay.
And I went there and started getting some credits in that summer. Okay. And then the first semester I got into was at University of North Texas. It's a great year, loved it, because I played on the golf team in high school. And so a gentleman would always come and want to play with us. He was about 65 or 70 at the time, and he liked to see young guys and play with us. Mm-hmm. And his name was Willis Tate. He was chancellor at SMU. And so after 1 year at UNT, then I continued running into him. And he said, you know, Craig, why don't you come to SMU? I said, well, I really don't have enough money to leverage into that. I'm at UNT. He said, I'll make it happen for you. And so that's how I got to SMU. Okay. And was able to graduate 2 years at SMU, 1 year at UNT. And in the summers, I always took extra courses. Okay. As well. So that's how I got out of undergraduate school.
Now, were you doing anything like as far as entrepreneurial ventures or anything? Was that happening while you were in undergrad?
Yes, but I went through the mowing until I was about 16.
Okay.
Then I started working at a bank that was in Oak Cliff, which was at that time originally white, that a lot of times over the years, it started being about 50 black, 50 white, and then later the Browns came in.
Okay.
So I was working there in the summers, and I got a job when I was 11 years old. So in the summers, instead of playing, I was always working.
Right.
So I did the first year of they had a huge room that had office supplies that always had to be maintained and climb a ladder and put that. So I did that each year in the summer. I had a job.
And how did you perform in undergrad? Because again, you've got dyslexia, and at that time, had it been diagnosed at that point, or are you still just kind of just thinking, things are really hard for me? What was that like?
I never thought of it that way, but later the word dyslexia, I think, came out when I was in 8th, 9th, 10th grade, somewhere in that range, but I never knew much about it. I was just trying to get through.
Gotcha.
So you want to be surviving, not thriving, yeah. And that's what I was trying to do. So anyway, I got through high school and then through the college.
Okay, so then when does Wharton come into play? Because you're working at the bank, you go North Texas, you wind up at SMU, which, by the way, I'm glad that we share that, and pony up.
Yeah.
So go Ponies. Then all of a sudden you end up in the Ivy League. Tell me what was the idea? When did you start to think that's a possibility, and kind of what took you to Wharton?
Well, I felt like the money was in the finance arena. And at that time, there was Harvard, Stanford, and the University of Pennsylvania, which is the Wharton School. Yeah. And I applied to all three of them. And I got into the Wharton School, and Harvard was marginal, and Stanford was a doable deal. But I only wanted to go one more year of college. And it's all for the wrong reasons, but that's what I wanted. So only the University of Penn at Wharton would let me go summer, fall, spring, and summer.
Okay.
And that's why I chose Wharton. I'd never been to Philadelphia, and that was a wake-up call when I arrived up there. But I enjoyed the graduation part of it. Yeah. But during the days, they were tough.
So, and then when it was there, did you go into banking right after that? What did you do after you finished at Wharton?
I went out of Wharton, and which was the most difficult thing I'd ever done in my entire life.
Really?
Only time I ever took off was on a Sunday afternoon from about 3 to 5 to go to a restaurant and eat. Other than that, I studied 7 days a week. And the one time I did go home for Christmas, I left literally on Christmas Eve. Mm-hmm. But everybody in those classes was a lot smarter. So I was really always just, trying to, it was a pass-fail mm-hmm. back in those mm-hmm. days. Mm-hmm. But so I did that. And then the first job that I had, I had a friend in Dallas that was a lot older than me, that was one of the top stockbrokers, and I'd met him because he and I'd worked on a political deal together. He said, I got a guy you need to meet. So I said, okay. So he says, this guy's an ultra entrepreneur, and he had built up a company, then he rolled it into a conglomerate, and later the conglomerate virtually collapsed, but it wasn't because of him. His was the only company out of 77 that was making payroll for us.
Wow.
And so I met him. I was really impressed with him. He was impressed with me. And I don't know why he was with me, but it was the Wharton MBA. He was from Mississippi and had an undergraduate degree. And he was a phenomenal guy.
Wow. And so what after that took you back? Now, are you back in Texas at this time?
Whenever back in Texas.
Okay. And what was your first, after the lawn mowing business and working at the bank, what was your next entrepreneurial venture? And what was it that made you decide you wanted to become an entrepreneur?
I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. And with him, it was a unique situation that I didn't create that existed. He had 77 companies in a conglomerate, and all of them except three were losing a ton of money. So he was selling all those off, and the one he created was still around. So I worked with him, and when I got there, I was his right-hand person on the finance. Then I got looking. It was a public company, and I could not read the public the reports.
Wow.
And I'm saying, oh, my gosh. I've got an MBA from Wharton, and this is not working well. So I called up three different friends that were at Wharton that I went with. And so at this time, the 10-Ks had just come out. That was a new area for SEC. So, and FedEx had just opened. So I called them. I said, I'm going to send you this deal. Would you read it and tell me, explain it? So I sent it out, FedEx, to all of them. Then I call them back, and they're looking at this and going, we can't make tails or heads of this deal. I said, well, that's a good deal. That makes me not feel bad about myself.
Right.
So I said, okay, I'm going to do this the way that I would normally do it. I'm going to go to the accounting. I want to find out how much cash we have in the bank today. I'm going to write it down. Now I'm going to go over to the different accounting department that's payables, and I want to know how much we owe and when we have to pay it. Then I want to know where the receivables are, and I go to a different floor there. Right. So I put this back together, and this stock is selling at a quarter. And it wasn't traded very often, but it was at that time real small. So anyway, I looked at that, and I'm going, oh, my gosh, this stock is worth about 15 times what it's selling for. So I had a little bit of money left over from college that I'd saved. Uh-huh. Then I went to my grandparents and borrowed a little bit of money. And my parents, I didn't ever ask for money. And so I put that together. And then my dad had asked me what's going on. I told him. He said, that's unusual. And he had just a high school education, but very successful. Uh-huh. So he started buying the stock, and it went up. I didn't know that he was buying it. Then he told his friends about it. And then shortly thereafter, about 2 months later, the guy that was the CEO walks in the room. He says, Crook, what are you doing? I understand you own some of the stock. And I go, well, okay. But I didn't want to tell him because, I back in the day, I didn't know if he wanted me to buy or not.
Right.
So then he said, some other people are out there driving up the stock. And I didn't want him to drive it up because, he owned control.
Right.
So anyway, I worked with him. And after a year, I'd bought three companies for him that two of them I found.
Yeah.
And then he wanted me to be in operations. And I said, I'm really not an operator. I'm more of an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. And that's when I'd made a lot of money with him based on that stock. I was the third highest paid guy out of Wharton at that time. But as you know, no matter what your salary is, you're still not going to have a lot of savings out of it. But I made the money on the stock.
So now, lesson for the listener here. You found a way within a larger organization to exercise your entrepreneurial spirit and your muscles. Tell me what, and you start buying companies. So what do you look at whenever you're looking at a deal and you're looking at a potential acquisition, and you did something there, and I've mentioned this in previous podcasts that I was terrible at in my early days as a business person was I wouldn't have sent I wouldn't have FedExed the financial statements out to friends and asked them. That was my, because I would have thought, well, that means that I'm stupid. You had the confidence and the sense to actually go do it. So I think one, that's something that's always to be learned. It took me probably, and I've mentioned this before, that going to graduate school and going to SMU, because I was the same way. I was sitting in a class, and any of my classmates that listen to this, they go, yeah, Jason, you were probably the dumbest of all of us. I'm looking around, and I thought, all these people are so much brighter than me. But the one thing that I noticed was even the smartest members of the cohort, they would ask questions. So I thought, well, if they're asking the questions, so maybe I'm not so dumb. So I got to believe that your innate instinct to do that had to help you when you would start evaluating these companies. So kind of walk me through how you get in that role, and then what an enormous responsibility. How old are you at this point?
I was 23, four years old.
Young age. Yeah. Looking at evaluating. So walk me through whenever there was a potential acquisition, how you evaluate a company and kind of the work ethic that you developed during that process.
These were coming actually from him.
Okay.
Not that he sorted them out, but some other people said, hey, you need to buy this company. You need to buy this company. Mm-hmm. So again, I just get to the basics, get out a pencil and paper, and I want to know how much cash is there. Mm-hmm. And then we need to know the receivables, the payables, are the assets long-term, are they short-term, are they mid-term, are there offices, what leases are out there. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, you'd lease a Xerox machine and stuff. So you need to know all that. And I believe the accountants a lot of times are all right. Mm-hmm. But in the same time, if there's any way to cover up stuff internally and not be truthful to some of your accountants that are doing this, you don't know the real deal. Mm-hmm. So I always start at the bottom. Cash first. Mm-hmm. Where's the bank accounts?
Right.
And then where are the receivables? And then I'll always ask the head of accounting, you know, will you sign your name that these receivables are all we have?
Yeah.
And I get them to sign off and date.
Wow. Wow. And that's so, and it's so, it always strikes me, sometimes the most basic and fundamental things are the biggest things to do, right? I mean, you talked about how much cash is in the bank. One of my favorite movie scenes is in the movie Sling Blade with Billy Bob Thornton. And Billy Bob, he's working at a small engine repair shop. And these guys are all consternating over why this lawnmower won't run. Finally, they call Carl over, who is the simplest of all of them, right? He walks over, and the first they say, Carl, would you take a look at this thing and tell us why it won't work? He kneels down, unscrews the gas cap, looks and says, it ain't got no gas in it. Yeah. And so, I mean, the most simple thing, that's kind of exactly what you're doing. The first thing you do when you're evaluating a company is the most simple thing. How much gas is in the tank? How much money's in the bank? You know, and so I think that is a very good lesson to learn. Okay, so how long are you in this role, and then what's happening next?
He wanted me to take over one of the companies to manage. I said, I really don't want to manage. You know, I want to figure out something else.
Right.
So I'd made a considerable amount of money on this deal. And so I went back to where I was, and I'd start reading. And there was a swimming pool at the apartment complex condo. I'd bought a condo. And so I was going through, and I was really taken by this company that sold a protein powder. And it was really unique. Back in the day, that wasn't really done. First year, they did $1 million in sales. The next year, $10 million. The next year, $80 million. They moved from Florida to Dallas, and they had come to Dallas, and they had spent a gazoo of money. Not any of the three had ever managed a business. And then very quickly, that whole deal tanked.
Okay.
But I was really interested in the customer base, and it wasn't available because it had just been shattered after this thing. But their head of sales I talked to, and so he joined me, and it was a real unique product. We were able to do that. So I started this company. After about 4 or 5 months, he left. But anyway, I started building that company.
Okay.
And it was people that really wanted nutrition. And that was the time I got in it. And the first year, we made money, $75,000, which
wow.
I was, you know, and my expenses were very small. Mm-hmm. Small office, didn't take any salary type deal. And then each year it grew. And after 3 years, it was doing pretty well.
So what, and do you mind, what was the name of that company?
Heritage Corporation of America.
Okay, Heritage Corporation. And now, how does that happen? Let's peel back that, because like we talked, you and I share a passion for nutrition and longevity and that sort of thing. It's one of my favorite topics. I'm always trying to figure out, you know, especially the older I get, the younger I want to be, right? Like
correct.
Everybody else. And so You see the business, and I remember, of course, back in that time, I remember the first thing I ever had was like Joe Weider protein, mm-hmm. you know, protein. Shaqley was one of the first, you know, multi-level marketing deals. So you see this as a potential business. How in the world do you start putting all the pieces together to turn this into a business? And what was the business model? Was it multi-level marketing? Was it direct-to-consumer? And why? Kind of take me through starting up your first real business like that.
It was direct to the customer, and then you could bring people in, and you just get a certain revenue. It wasn't exactly multi-level, but it was a bifurcated situation. And by hiring one of the guys that worked there at that company, he had access to all the accounts. So we picked up a few, but not a lot. But then word got out about this product that we had that was phenomenal, and it took off. And so that's how we I got going.
And how long did you have that business?
I had it for a little over 3 years because a lady that was using the product came to our office because we didn't sell out of the office. There was a warehouse. And so she really wanted to talk about buying the business. And I thought, well, okay. And she was very sweet. Then later it comes to find out her husband shows up. He's got a very successful company. And I think he was willing to buy it, just to give her something to do. That's what she wanted. So so anyway, it was a lot more money than I thought that it was worth. And so I sold that.
Okay. And then what's next from there?
From that point on, there was an opportunity. The economy in Texas was going straight up. And this was in the 80s. Real estate was going phenomenal. Under Ronald Reagan, the Secretary of Treasury was Reagan that used to run Merrill Lynch. So he changed the rules around, and that allowed a lot of savings loans to loan as much money as they had to one person, which that was the worst thing they could have ever done. And so that took off the real estate market in Texas, and that went really well. And then oil was going, it was at 40. And it was going up to 120. Banks were lending on it at $100 a barrel, even though it didn't exist. And then the real estate market had gone unbelievable because they could take a $30 million savings loan in small towns, buy it for usually about $500,000, and then they could do CDs and run up $100 to $500 million overnight in deposits through New York. That was the first time. So then all the real estate started going. So all of this went up, and then all of a sudden, when oil went from about the 47 mark instead of 120, it drops down to 12. And that was the beginning of the fall in Texas. And then right behind it were all the savings loans, that all these real estate deals, and all the buildings were overbuilt, more hotels than you needed, more buildings than you needed, more apartments than you needed, and they all collapsed. And then right behind that was the banks. So 13 of the 14 largest banks in Texas collapsed. Out of the independent banks, we lost about 62% of them. And so one of those banks that I was saw at a very low price, I got in there to take the money I had and put all of my money in the deal. And then I knew it would be a five-year turnaround. And just as we were holding it together on that fourth year is when that everything collapsed. And it wasn't any loans that we had put in, but we were getting, anytime there's a problem loan, it takes forever to get them to pay it back. It takes a long time. They can't go to another bank. So we were there 4 and 5 years. And so I told the board, I said, this is not going to, we're not going to be able to make it with everybody else already failed. And we don't have the capital. And so I left, and then a year later it was closed. We were the only bank in Texas that got closed that we did not get sued, because my management team did not have anything to do with creating the bad loans. We were working them out from day one. So anyway, that took me back to about a negative. Back in the day, I want to say $4 to $6 million that I signed deficiency notes.
Wow.
And so I was one of the few that asked for a deficiency notes, because later they changed the rules, the FDIC.
Yeah.
So I was one of the few that didn't have to file bankruptcy, but it took me 8 years to get back to zero net worth.
Wow. Okay. So now that's where I want to stop for just a minute. So A lot of people, they hear when you have your big equity event, and for, well, I'm going to try not to use private equity VC terms because not everybody listening, you know, wants to hear that. Equity event, essentially, you sold your company and a lot of money comes in. So take, and I want to hear it from you. I don't want to preempt it, but I hear pretty much a universal story from everyone I ask this question, or that tells me the story about them when they had their big, their payout, what that's like. Tell me what that day was like for you. Guy comes in your estimation, he's willing to overpay you for it, but you're fine. You'll take his money, put his wife in business. That day comes, the wire transfer or whatever, however it was done back then, happens. What goes through your mind? What are you feeling? Go back to that day and describe it.
It feels like when you're playing baseball, and I grew up in Little League a little bit, and occasionally you'd get lucky and hit a home run or something out there, and it was just that same feeling.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like, what am I going to do tomorrow? Yeah. I'm going, this is like unbelievable. It was more money than I thought the company was worth.
Right.
So I took it, and then I said, you know, to myself, self, what are we going to do?
Yeah.
And then I just started reading magazines that summer, all the business magazines, Wall Street and Business Week, Fortune, Forbes, et cetera, et cetera. And that's when I came across that other company that had built up from $80 million in 3 years, and then it was starting to collapse. And it just moved to Dallas. It came out of Florida.
Right.
So I thought, man, if they can do that, they didn't have a business background, surely I can do that.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's kind of one of the things that, you know, one of my closest friends and mentors, he went through the same thing. He built up a durable medical equipment company, sold it, and then it was like, I got to go find something else to do with the capital, and he ends up in the assisted living business, and that's where he truly made his fortune, you know, kind of unexpected, but it was just that, okay, just because we've hit a home run, there's more games to play. Right. I mean, right. You can't just sit on your laurels. But then you go from hitting a home run to now you have a significant negative net worth. What was that like? I mean, what and how do you, because a lot of people don't recover from that. A lot of people would not do what you did, which is the which is exercise the integrity to go, I refuse to take bankruptcy. If there's another alternative, I'm going to take that. So what when you were in your alone moments, how did you keep your confidence up? How did you keep your ability to persevere and go, hey, the sun's going to come up tomorrow, so that means there's going to be work. There's work to be done. What was that like? How did you keep your mind engaged, all of it, to get through that time?
At the same time, I had another situation that happened. I had been married, was going to be married for life. And we had a two-year-old son, and I came back from the day, and I mentioned to my wife, I said, it's going to be a miracle if we get out of this. The economy in Texas collapsed. New York didn't collapse. California didn't collapse. Chicago didn't collapse. Miami didn't. It was just Texas. Mm-hmm. And so I told her, I said, it's going to be a miracle if we get out of this without filing bankruptcy. And I'm going to try to do these notes. And so 2 days later, we had a son that was 2 years old. And she came in and said, you know, I'm leaving.
Wow.
And I said, okay, as long as I can have my son, good luck. And she said, well, I need some cash. And I said, well, I don't have a lot of cash, and it's really pledged, but I'll give you what I have. So I got to keep my son. She left. And there was a lady that was working for me one day a week at the house for 2 years before he was born. And so I got a couple of other positions that I could do. I knocked on the door of Harold Simmons in Dallas, Texas, because he was in the newspaper business section almost every day. Gene Phillips was in that. Tom Hicks was there. Three guys. Mm-hmm. So I knocked on all of their doors. They didn't know me from Adam. Luckily, I got in to see them. Harold would only see usually one person a day and take three phone calls. And Gene, I got in. He's a different deal. He was doing deals continually. Mm-hmm. And both Harold hired me and Gene Phillips hired me. And I became their right hand on projects. And a lot of those were political projects, too, as well as finance.
Yeah.
So that's how I got enough money for food for my son. And then when they wanted me to go out of town, the lady that was working one day a week, said, I'll be happy to help stay with your son. And she was she'd been married, but she's divorced. She still is with me today, 38 years later.
Wow.
And so that was how that worked.
Well, all right. So, and what? How old are you at this point?
60. At that point?
Yeah.
I was 30, probably right in the 28 to 30 range.
So what was it? What did you say to, I mean, because you're talking about, and for those of you who are not familiar with the Metroplex and Dallas Business or whatever, I mean, the three names he just rattled off, they are power players.
They were all billionaires.
Billionaires. I mean, these are serious players. So what was it that got you mentally in a place where you go, I am at the depths of the valley, but I'm going to go knock on billionaires' doors and say, I have something to offer you. I mean, there's a lot of people listening to this, Craig, I got to believe, that either they're in that situation, they've been in that situation, they hope to goodness they never find themselves in that situation, but should they, you've been through that valley and come through it, what was it that got you through those times and made you, again, go, here's what I'll do, I'm at the worst of the worst in my career thus far, but I'm going to go tell some billionaires I've got something to offer them. How do you do that?
First, it was very fortunate to get in, and I did.
How did you? Because networking is one of the things you're a master of. You're an incredible connector, and I think that's a very valuable lesson for anyone in any sort of business. So what was your strategy to get those meetings?
Well, for example, with Harold Simmons, I called, and the reception answered. Okay. And then usually she would defer all stuff to not even call back. But then she put me through to his secretary, and I said, ma'am, you know, I'm born and raised in Dallas, and here's my story. I'd love to talk to Mr. Simmons, and there might be some work for me. Right. And so that's how I got in.
Wow.
And then Gene Phillips was exactly the same way. Marty Stevens at that time was his assistant. Okay. And she allowed me to come see him. And so each time I said, you know, I'm looking for a job. This is my background. This is where I'm at. I have a deficiency note of about $7 million. I'll pay it back. It's just going to take some time. And I have a 2-year-old son, and my wife walked out type deal.
Wow.
And they both hired me.
And that's the thing that I think, that's why I wanted to get to that, because one of the things I've learned, Craig, and that's one of the reasons why you're sitting here is because I asked. I mean, you have no reason to sit across the table from me. There's nothing in this for you. But again, for the listener out there, I can tell you through my life and what Craig has just described to you, a lot of times it's just being transparent, being honest, and saying, this is what's happened. This is why I'm here. I'm one of you as far as geographically. I'm a hometown guy, and I'm willing to show you my warts. Would you help me out? And I think that's respected. Would you agree? I mean, throughout just transparency, and it's so hard to find.
I didn't have another story to tell.
Perfect. Perfect. And you know, I guess it was Sam Rayburn that always said, if you tell the truth the first time, you don't have to remember what you said.
That's true. That is so true.
So, okay, now you become kind of the right-hand man, and that's where, just from knowing you, the time I had, that's where your network really starts to take off, because you become somewhat of a gatekeeper, right, to these billionaires. And so tell me how that ends up evolving and what that looks like.
Both of them have different ways of managing 180 degrees, but both of them had corporate jets.
Yeah.
And I had been lucky to know some other people in Dallas that sometimes I'd get a ride for free. I didn't have the money. Through that, I had a different area for them. And Harold Simmons would give money to politicians, but he never wanted to meet them. He didn't like to meet people at all. He'd just see one person a day. And he's highly introverted. And same thing with Gene Phillips. And Gene thought about it, and because they asked me what else I did, and I told them about the political. I'd been in it since I was 17 years old, helped Don Frisco win, and each one on. And I said, you know, there's some deals coming up. Do you want to look at these for the politicians? Sure. Harold says, okay, here's the checks, Greg, but you go deliver them. Mm-hmm. And finally, after 3 months, I said, you know, Harold, I don't tell them I represent you because I'm scared to use your name without your permission. Mm-hmm. He says, tell them it's me. And the same thing with Gene Phillips. Wow. And then we did some events. I was telling him one, there was one with Ronald Reagan coming down to the Astrodome. And we not only took a big table, but he had a DC-9. Harold had a Falcon. And they said it at corporate office. I never said a word to corporate, but all the people would, you know, like, who are you? Right. And then so we're going to take the down with his wife and myself and other people. There was 40 seats on that plane.
Right.
And at the last minute, they couldn't go. But people told me in the office, you're probably not going to do it because that jet has never gone up without him in it. So long story, everybody in Dallas I'd called that was going to give money wanted to go on that jet. And so I came back the next day, and he was in a 7-story building. And they had a huge number of companies spread around the world in the U.S. And all the people were like, what did you do? Nobody has ever taken that jet out by themselves. I said, well, I had nothing to do with this. Mm-hmm. It was his jet. And he says, well, nobody's in the company has ever heard that. You know, so it wasn't that I was special. It was just the way the cards landed.
But you had the opportunity, Craig, and, you know, talk to the listener about the importance of relationship. I mean, because I think that that's one of the things, again, that you're known for. You have relationships and that you've nurtured. And I can tell you from my own personal experience, if there's one thing that I tell every undergrad that's coming out, about to start in the workforce or whatever, is that networking is one thing. But that can be just kind of a slick, how many people can I count up that I know? Mm. It's not just networking. It's the building of relationships and gaining people's trust that's where the real equity is. Would you agree? And so
true.
How have you managed that process?
I am very direct, very quickly. Mm-hmm. So if, you know, Harold said, Craig, you know, look at that stock. Tell me what you said. You know, I'll come back in. I said, I think it's a dog with fleas.
Okay.
Why? He'll ask me. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, if you look at this and this and this, it doesn't really look solid.
Right.
And he'd look at that, and he'd go, you're right, let's move on. And the same thing with Gene. It was exactly the same. You know, he would put me on a project. We're looking at buying a company type deal. And everybody else in the company wanted to buy it. I'm going, Gene, I wouldn't buy that deal. I just don't know if mm-hmm. there's, you know, too much stuff under the covers that will later come up. But anyway, each time I was very direct. Mm-hmm. I didn't tell them what they wanted to hear. I just told them the facts.
Right, which a lot of the times those guys aren't used to that. And I found that as well, is that at the bottom of everyone, they're just a human being, right? Right. And you find out when you're dealing with people of great influence, the proverbial power or whatever, they're used to everyone kind of telling them what they want to hear. And if you're that guy that in a humble and, for lack of a better word, diplomatic way, is willing to tell them what they may not want to hear, it goes a long way, right?
It does.
Yeah. Okay, so then what's next for you? Because I'm kind of jumping around chronologically, because you find your way back into the nutrition business, right, of sorts, but not quite yet. So what kind of take me through the next chapter, if you will?
Well, I after making some good money with these guys, and I was able to go back and start paying back some of that money. Mm-hmm. And then I came across a product that I thought could really do some things really well, and it was a small capsule tablet type situation, because mm-hmm. I'd gotten into the industry. Mm-hmm. And so with that, I put that together. I put some money, the cash that I had, and it didn't take a lot. But it took right back off.
Right.
And, you know, we just had an office that we rented, so we didn't have any actual CapEx to speak of.
Right.
But we put up money I did for a pharmaceutical manufacturer. Back in the day, nutritions weren't made in pharmaceuticals. We were the first company in the industry to use a pharmaceutical company to make a nutritional product. So anyway, that got out there, and it just took off. And after 3 months, it was profitable, and we had cash.
And what was it, like a multivitamin company, or was it weight loss? What was its intended?
We were the first company that put vitamins together in a package. They had sealed.
Yeah.
So you would buy them, you get 30 days worth, and we'd had about five or six of those capsules in a first time it had ever been done. But we used a pharmaceutical lab again that did this. So that took off, and then we added some additional products, and we were just at the right place at the right time.
When did you start to, I mean, it sounds silly. I mean, we all know the value of longevity. We all know the value of good health, but not everybody practices it. So tell me where that comes from with you, because I know that is something that's very important to you, is longevity, health. And so you've been able to tie both, which is kind of one of the things I envy most about you, because that's a passion I have. You've combined both your affinity for fitness and nutrition with, and been able to monetize it as well. So where does that come from, and when did you start studying it and realizing I couldn't just make, it's not just about making money, but this is really something that helps you be a better human being and function better. Where does that come from?
The first company in nutrition was all about money. Second time was making products for me.
Okay.
Because I would go see people that were 40 years old and they looked like they were 60. Mm-hmm. I would see them 40 that looked 40, and I would see a few that were 40 that looked 30 or 25 years old.
Right.
And I said to myself, self, what's the driver behind this? And I ask enough questions that it dawned on me that you need nutrition that the body wants, not what your mind wants. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're hungry and I say, how about a burger and fries? And you're going, yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
But that's not what the body really wants. It's what you want mentally.
Right.
And so that's when I focused on my own dietary, my own exercise program, and then the highest profile of nutritional vitamins, minerals, and herbs put together.
Okay.
And through that, you know, I started going to Cooper Clinic 1979 each year through, and Ken and me did mine for a while, then to another doctor and another doctor. That's just every year a physical.
Right.
And I'm today, you know, I'm in the top 0.1%. There's no anything that I'm 65 years old. I don't have any prescriptions that I use. You know, I sleep well. I exercise well. And so the energy difference that I've got compared to so many of the people that are in my range each year gets a larger gap
right
between the top and the bottom.
Yeah, and I do know that you are, and I know the calendar you keep and how you are always on the go. So you literally, I've seen it. So what is your routine now? And let's talk about some of the things that right now, you know, and I try all these things, like intermittent fasting, you know, ketogenic diets. And I don't like diets. I like lifestyle, right? But I will plug in those things occasionally to see for, and it's not just about weight loss. It's not loss. It's not just about strength gains, but cognitive, you know, ability enhancement. That's the sort of things I'm always looking for. So what is your routine now as far as dietary, nutrition, working out, mindfulness, or do you meditate? You know, kind of what is your routine from the time you get up to the time you go to bed? What does that look like?
Usually I'm up in the mornings between 5:30, 5:45 naturally. Then I have a swim jet in my garage. So I put that in about 10 years ago, and there's no fatigue on any other things. You know, before I'd had a treadmill in the house and then a stepper, et cetera.
Right.
So the swimming works great for me. And then I do fruits and vegetables and nuts. And I usually, like we did today, I ordered salmon. Mm-hmm. So I'll usually do at the time I grew up, we did, you know, steaks and Mexican mm-hmm. food.
Right.
All that went away probably about 30 years ago, 35 right. for me.
Right.
And when I force myself into those after a while, I found out my body works better. So I don't have any aches and pains. I've been very fortunate. No prescriptions from a doctor. And I've just been very fortunate in that zone.
Okay. Do you count calories at all?
No.
Okay. Just portion control.
Portion control with fruits, vegetables, nuts. And you know, usually once, say, every 7 to 10 days, mm-hmm. Maybe a hamburger once or twice.
Yeah.
But I'll do that at lunch as opposed to dinner.
Okay. Okay.
And the body just burns it quicker.
Right. Right. Now, when do you decide to become an author?
A lot of people said, tell me what you're doing and why. And I never thought of that. Yeah. So anyway, I just started working that and then put that together. And we sold a lot more of those books than I really thought back in that day.
Yeah.
So I did that. And then later I just did another one. And that one's done very well as well.
Yeah. And talk about some of the mindsets and the strategies that are in those books so that the listeners can understand. Because that's... To me, that is the essence of how you have maintained through. You have an ability to, for your very positive thinking. A lot of the things that, you know, be it Tony Robbins, Ryan Holiday, and Stoicism, and all the other things out there, you have kind of, were an early adopter to a lot of these things. So take us through some of the mental strategies that you've actually written about that have made you successful and that you continue to maintain today.
Never, 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 never give up. Mm. World may be crashing, families around you may be crashing, things at home, but stay focused, knowing that tomorrow will be better than today. And it's perseverance.
Yeah. And how do you stay in that mindset whenever, how have you been able to, because this is one of the things that's run in my family personally, is clinical depression. I mean, we've had some folks that have really, and bipolarism. And so, you know, it's one of those things that I've had to adopt strategies whenever I kind of get what Winston Churchill called a case of the black cloud. You know, he was someone that suffered from depression. You know, for me, it's, I have to get myself out and do something physical, whether it's get on my Peloton, go do pull-ups, I've got to do something physical that kind of snaps me out of it. What strategies have you put into place to match with that mindset, to get you back into the reminder almost that tomorrow is another day?
Tomorrow is another day, and I'm always looking for a different strategy. So if the one I'm at currently is not working, what strategy do we need to go to? And a lot of that is just doing enough of them that one of them will catch on. Mm. So when I come up with those, that doesn't mean it's going to be successful.
Right.
But I'll follow it until I can go, no, we got to go find another one.
Right.
So, you know, never, 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 never give up. And that's the way I've always been.
Right. So what are you working on now that you're excited about? What's your next big project?
Well, number one, I would love my great-grandfather, my grandfather, and my father were all in the military. Mm-hmm. I was going into the military and out of high school. Uh-huh. And the Vietnam War ended in February, and I got out of college, out of high school in May. So I did financially pretty well. And I have two sons that are phenomenal and have great, everything's there. And my faith is so strong. And so I said, you know, I'd love to serve America. And that's why I've been working with the current administration. Mm-hmm. And I've had a lot of supporters in that I think we'll get an appointment here pretty soon. Mm-hmm. And that way I'll be able to give back to America just like my family has.
Right.
And that really is something that I'm driven for, not for the job, but to check off that I've done what my family did to help America.
Right. And that's one of the things, you know, I try to keep this podcast as politic-free as possible, but as part of your civic duty, I know it's a big part of your life. I mean, you and I share that, and it's not about ideological, that's a conversation for somebody else's show. But to the listener, and a good example of that right now is, you know, David Koch just passed away,
right?
And I think a lot of people were taken aback by how many causes he supported that were completely polar to what he's accused of. You know, he's the big, dark, ultra-right-wing boogeyman, when in fact, he actually partnered with George Soros on some things. And so both he and his brother, they've really taken the stance of, you know, using our wealth to help shape policy that we think is good is a way to give back. So, and at those early stages with those billionaires, it sounds like that's where you saw them doing the same thing, kind of putting their money where their mouth is. And it's not all about just the evil corporate guy trying to shape things into a way that will yield the best benefits for them. Talk a little bit about that individual that's out there, whether they're on the left or the right, why it's important to be engaged in the process, regardless of where you fall on the issues. Talk a little bit about that, because I know it's such a big deal to you.
We have been so fortunate in the history of the world. Some people are saying it's going back to, you know, 100 million years, on and on. So regardless of that, America stands alone. And it's by building from people that left other countries that could not make it in that country for one reason or the other, and they wanted a new start. And so when you look at that, you want to help other people. And I've been very blessed. And so therefore you want to say, you know, how can we make America even better for our children and our grandchildren? And those are the things that really drive people. Now, and the Koch brothers, you know, those are trust fund babies. That was all handed to them. And usually the trust fund babies don't normally give away a lot of money because they know they can't make money. And they don't want to lose what they have. But the entrepreneurs don't get so much at one level, but they'll give money to other people to go give it to other people, just like with Harold Simmons and just like Gene Phillips and several other friends. And they'd say, okay, Craig, that's a good one. Here's a check. Go give it to them.
Right.
And that's what is the driver.
Right, right. So it's a love of America.
It is a love of America. And everybody, if you'll look at, start going back to about 1850 and 60, all the inventions that have been made, 80% of them have been made in America. We're talking about a telegraph, a radio, a telephone. It just goes on and on. The computer, you know, University of Pennsylvania is the first one, and the software, and just anything that you can, cell phones, anything you can think of has come out of America, and that creates this entrepreneurship to lift up, and when the people are making money, they will then reach out to others to help them come up to the next ring. And that's what about America is about.
You know, I still remember the first time I was as part of graduate school. We were over in China, and I'm in Chengdu, China, and I'm at a Dell manufacturing facility. And the thing that struck me the most as I was there wasn't even the fact that Dell is an American-based company. It wasn't that. But I looked at an assembly line, and I thought, Henry Ford is an American, an uneducated American, by the way. He's the reason why here they are today, and at that time, 2013, using his ingenuity to assemble an American product in Chengdu, China, in the form of the assembly line. And so I agree with you. There have been, you know, for all the ills, I don't know a nation on earth that is lily white and completely clear of humanity and mistakes that human beings make. I don't know where that place is. But I do know one thing. The United States of America has been the place where the human experience has been able to flourish and reach its potential greater than any corner of this earth. So I completely agree with you. And those are, and that's the thing. And that's why I wanted to bring that up, because, you know, as people look into who the next guest is, they'll say, and the wonderful thing is, if you look at Craig Keelan's website, you'll see that it's not just one side of the aisle that he visits with, you know. And so I appreciate you making that point. Craig, one of the last question I always ask every guest, and almost universally every single guest I have has read The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, you know, and I always say that I realize I'm kind of onto something by the quality of people that I'm interviewing, because they all read the book or have read at least one of the books I mentioned. But in Covey's Seven Habits, he talks about, imagine walking down the street and you hear music, you follow the music, and it's coming from a church. You walk into the church and you realize you're at a funeral. You walk up and you realize it's at your funeral. And that's one of those moments where he actually has you close the book and go, okay, when it's all said and done, what do you want people to say about you and the life you led? And so, as someone who I know has lived such a purposeful life, what is it you want others to say, and what legacy do you want Craig Keelan to leave behind?
Truthful, helping others, And the more I can help other people, they will bring me along with them.
Wonderful. Craig, this has been an absolute pleasure. I thank you so much for your friendship, and I thank you for spending this time with me.
Thank you. I'm very honored to be here, and God bless you, and God bless America.
Thank you, brother. Hey, folks, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Texas Titans podcast. Before you go, I wanted to let you know where you can find us out there on the interwebs. You can go to show notes as well as listen to all the past episodes and look for upcoming shows at texttitans.blog. Also, that has all the different formats that you can listen to the show on if you go there. So texttitans.blog. You can also go to jasonrightnow.com. That has not only a link to the podcast, but it also has a link to my Make Your Own Rules blog that I think you'll enjoy. So please check that out. Also, it has information about my executive coaching business, speaking, and anything else like that. So jasonrightnow.com. That's literally just my name, jasonrightnow.com. On Twitter, I'm at jasonwrighttx. I would really appreciate a follow. I have not been a big Twitter user, so I need you guys to help me with that. So please take the time to go out to jasonwrighttx, find me, and follow me. I'm trying to get more active with it. And so if you'll engage with me, I'll try to do a better job of engaging with you. So I would appreciate that. And then on Instagram, I'd really appreciate a follow there. I'm at jasonrightnow. Again, my name, now. So please follow me on Instagram. And then on Facebook, I'm also at jasonwrighttx. So check us out there. I'm also on LinkedIn, so look for me there. I try to use as many platforms as possible to let you know about upcoming shows, past shows, and then also just anything that I find interesting. I'm trying to push it out and get better with the social media. So please check us out there and follow us. I would be most grateful. And also, please do not forget, it means the world to me for you to go to iTunes, give us a rating. Right now, we've got that 5-star rating. I'm hoping to hold that. Please, please, please. The comments that people are writing are so very kind. Thank you so much. It means the world to me. And that's how we keep moving up in the ranks. And right now, we're crushing it with downloads. The show has really had incredible feedback thanks to you guys. So I'm grateful. Please keep that momentum going by giving us a review on iTunes. Thanks so much and have a great day. And as always, I could not be more grateful for you listening. Thanks.